The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. The party is over and time to go home.
What's your other motion? That's the one I want to hear.
Mr. Speaker, I move that this House stand adjourned, sine die.
On the motion of majority leader, this House stands adjourned, sine die.
Like a block party, another legislative session has come and gone. State lawmakers had one job, right? Well, perhaps the big story is what measures didn't make it. Joining Closer Look right off the bat with a few hours of sleep between them, our WABE politics team, Raul Bali and Sam Greenglass, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Hey, Rose, we're here. We're awake, I think.
Raul, you all right, dude? First question, one word, describe this legislative session. Take it, Sam.
Chaotic.
Okay, Raul?
Stop and go? Is that a one? Can I count that as one word?
Daniel? Does that count? Daniel's laughing. Yeah.
The parliamentarian says no. Roller coaster.
Not bad.
I mean, roller coaster then.
Well, we didn't have anyone hanging off a clock trying to stop the session. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google, was it Grover?
Denmark Grover.
Denmark Grover, 1964. Enough said.
Always next year.
Yeah. What was the biggest takeaway from Sine Die for you, Sam?
Well, I think kind of as you alluded to at the top, I think the story of last night was what didn't pass, not what did pass. I mean, there were some pretty significant pieces of legislation that were saved until the end that we entered into sine die, not knowing whether they were going to make it or not, or even get a vote at all. And I'd say if you look at the top line, most of those things either failed in a vote or didn't even get called up for a vote. I'd say the big things that are going to the governor's desk after last night, besides that constitutionally mandated budget, are pretty far and few between.
All right. Oh, well, Raul, what stood out for you?
There was a stunning amount of change with this incoming bound of senators and representatives. It has been decades since you had a new speaker, a new presiding officer, lieutenant governor of the Senate, a new majority leader on both sides, a new pro tem. You know, 40 to 50 new members in both bodies, and not just new members, but again, a changing face of this state. I mean,
two new caucuses. Yeah.
How could I have ever imagined 11 Asian Americans in, you know, and I'm speaking as an Asian American man, to have 11 in the legislature. So it's also a very different looking legislature. So, and I think that was what really we noticed here at the end. What are people's priorities? What are people's styles? What are people's substance? There was a lot of that just old-fashioned. There's just new people here.
Was there something different? You've covered it for a while here. So there was something different, not just in the makeup, but was there something different in the processes? And there was some typical, you know, lawmakers shenanigans and maneuvers. But was there anything different about the environment or the culture?
The dynamic between the House and Senate. Well, and you know, I always talk about this to people. There's always Republican versus Democrat, urban, rural, suburban dynamics. But the dynamics of the House versus the Senate, and to the point where it actually brought down significant legislation, was really noticeable. It was something I really harped on this session.
Noticeable. To you as well, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to one lawmaker on the way out last night as we were getting ready to go home, and she was like, today felt chaotic in a way that hasn't normally been in past sine dies, the unpredictability. And she kind of ascribed that to these two new leaders trying to figure out how to manage the big roles that they're in. And I think even Speaker Burns alluded to that in his press conference after session last night. Mm-hmm. You know, he said he learned some things in the last week in these final days where some of the biggest conflict between the House and the Senate spilled out over mental health and over the budget and some other issues, too.
Well, let's get right to it. I'm just going to throw out a measure and you all raise your hand like kindergarten. Medical cannabis.
That was so a little bit of what happened yesterday. Sam hung out in the House. I hung out in the Senate. Mm-hmm. That was the most compelling debate about what to do about Georgia's medical cannabis program. Right now, there are two licensees. They expect to get product on the market. But then there were issues with four other licensees, mm-hmm. and they were being challenged. What do you do about them? And the piece of legislation that was put on the table was a significant overhaul. It got rid of the Cannabis Commission. It gave the power to the Agriculture Commissioner. And you saw lawmakers who were just like, we're going to give all that power to one person.
Which is interesting because remember, it's been some years, folks, if you don't know, when the first law was passed about all of this. And it's taken this long to get to this point.
2015, it was legalized, but there was no way for Georgians to get it. Then they put a process together in 2019. But it's still not in people's hands. And you've got 26,000 Georgians and likelihood there's even more who would need the product who just don't have access to it. The debate was compelling, you know, and it lost by one vote. It needed 29 state senators. It got 28 and just audible gasp in the room that didn't happen.
So we still have the commission?
Still have the commission.
And we still got to get these four other licensees together.
And the question is that just going to be continuation through the lawsuit process? And will that get even messier because these two licensees, if they produce all the low THC oil for the people who need them, these other four may have some other damage issues that may start coming up.
Wow. Here we go. Expanding bail requirements.
So this was one that actually floundered in the last day of session. I thought it was going to be a clear shot to the end. What this bill would have done is added 30 or so more offenses that would have required bail, a lot of these nonviolent, including mm-hmm. misdemeanor possession of marijuana. And it did pass. It has passed both chambers, but there was disagreement over the different amended versions of the bills. And basically throughout the day, it was sent back and forth between the chambers and neither was willing to agree to the other chamber's version of the bill. So by the end of the day, we got to sine die, and this didn't get a final vote. Democrats spoke out against it pretty passionately, you know, citing Governor Nathan Deal in a lot of their speeches, mm-hmm. saying this flew in the face of the criminal justice reform that he pushed during his second term in office.
Which the governor in Georgia was praised for this complete turnaround in that area. Wow. Minimums for gang crimes. This was one that was also highly contested.
Because same vein here, too. The reforms brought by Nathan Deal factored into a lot of this conversation. But unlike cash bail, this one did get passed. This was a priority of Governor Kemp and Republicans who have made, you know, cracking down on violent crime a top priority in both their policy stances and their rhetoric heading mm-hmm. into this session. That one got done and it heads to the governor's desk.
Oh. Okay, rise and fall of sports betting.
You know, the guys from Political Breakfast were on this morning with Lisa, and I think they're right. This was probably the most possible paths to get online sports betting only, online sports betting on our phones, you know, under the Georgia Lottery and getting that passed. But, you know, in the end, I think in the end, the situation simply became you needed Democratic votes to mm-hmm. get this done. And whether you waited too late to get Democrats on board. Look, in past conversations I've had with Minority Leader James Beverly in the House, he's just like, look, this is one of the things we have leverage on. You're going to have to give something or work with us on something. And, you know, the lieutenant governor is pointing the finger at Democrats, but you've got to bring them on board knowing you've got Republicans who aren't going to vote for it.
I want to jump ahead to something real quick because this is some tape from yesterday. This is when the State House was voting on Senate Bill 233, a proposal for a state voucher plan to fund homeschooling and private schools and therapy. Let's take a listen.
Have all members voted? If so, the clerk will lock the machine. Members, this house will come to order.
Is that the housing, the house voucher, the housing voucher?
No, that
school voucher.
That's the school voucher.
And that was the sound that you heard was Democrats cheering in excitement.
So that was it.
This vote failed.
Yeah.
But it was such a stunner. And I was, so Sam's in the house. I'm across, what was, you'd say about 50 yards. You could hear it in the Senate. And when that reaction was so loud, it came across the Capitol into the Senate. And my head goes up. I'm like, did vouchers just fail? And then it popped up in my Twitter. It had failed.
Failed by one vote, right?
No, that failed by six.
By six, okay. Wow.
And Rose, you were talking just before in relation to sports betting about these few moments where Democrats have the ability to exert a little bit of the small clout that they do have. And vouchers, I think, is probably the best example of that.
And we should note, there were some Democrats that were in favor of at least
a couple,
yeah.
State Representative Misha Maynor.
And there were a lot of folk on Twitter that were, you know, let's go to Twitter. You know, Twitter is everything. But they were surprised by that and saying you're taking funding away from public schools.
And you also have Republicans who are being aimed at. You had more than a dozen Republicans who voted against it. And they may also have issues where you've got Republicans saying you didn't vote for this.
Mostly from rural areas. And part of the argument that has been made by opponents of vouchers is that there aren't a lot of private schools in these rural areas. So what you end up doing is funneling state money away from rural communities and to metro areas where there's tons of private schools.
And it was going to be, what, 6,500?
6,500 annual per kid.
Wow. District attorney's oversight.
You know, this is part of that bigger conversation about crime. You know, when you talk about, you know, you're setting these limits on bail, or you're setting these mandatory minimums. This is how much discretion do you give to district attorneys? And you have Democrats who are simply saying these are elected. These district attorneys are elected. They, you know, reflect the community. Okay. And if you want to hold them accountable, they're up for elections in 4 years.
That's the ultimate accountability measure, I guess.
You know, yeah. So, you know, if you have an issue with Fannie Willis, or Sherry Boston, or Deborah Gonzalez, you can vote them out of office. I mean, that's what happened to Paul Howard. You know, he got voted out. But you have Republicans, and you know, one of the interesting things is people keep bringing up Fannie Willis, but that's not the name that comes up at the state capitol. The names that come up at the state capitol are Deborah Gonzalez and about, you know, prosecuting low-level marijuana possession. Sherry Boston saying, I'm not going to you know go after abortion cases. So I am going to be so interested to see the implementation of oversight. You know, first of all, who's going to be appointed to these commissions, and then what they actually do.
And is this anywhere else in the nation?
The comparison that's been talked about at the Capitol is the same way this is how judges are handled here in the state of Georgia. That's been the kind of the comparison that keeps coming up. But again, the issue there and the conversation is, look, these are elected officials. Yeah. These are elected constitutional officials in the state.
Really interesting. Tenant protections.
This was another thing that did not get done. I think we all kind of talked at the very beginning of the session that this would be the session of housing, you know, at Eggs and Issues, Governor Kemp.
There was a
all
big
these other officials were
that.
Talking about housing. Kemp was saying, you know, we need to be willing. I'm all for local control, but we need to be willing to step in here on some of these zoning regulations that preclude affordable housing. But in the end, Rose, the only thing that really got done is a budget allocation for a rural workforce housing fund. But in terms of legislation, tenant protections, zoning rules, efforts to regulate investor-owned housing, none of these things got done. Even tenant rules, that was supposed to be bipartisan.
Very
it didn't even get a vote in the Senate. Yeah,
because you're right. At the beginning of the session, that was some housing. Every time we did a session with you all, it was housing.
And nothing.
It really is surprising how little got done on housing. And I don't know if that's going to be some major conversations on the off session. It's one of the things that I've heard is going to be a conversation. But, you know, if people are still struggling with housing, and you talk about it all the time, you know, lawmakers, Republican, Democrat, urban, rural, suburban, realize this is a problem.
Elections, time off. Yay. Grant funding. y'all ain't getting it.
Yeah, so
it's basically what it says in the law.
We had two election bills. One was this one that you mentioned about time off for voting during early voting. They also included some provisions requested by the Secretary of State's office that is basically cleaning up some holes in election law that passed with bipartisan support. The other bill, SB 222, basically bans election boards from directly accepting grant money. You know, election offices have been increasingly strapped for funds. There's more demands being placed on them, especially with these mass voter challenges that have happened. And now they won't be able to accept any of this funding to help run their infrastructure. It can still be funneled through the Secretary of State's office, mm-hmm. but it's really unclear if that'll make it to the election offices that say they need it.
And meanwhile, counties will tell you that they are strapped. They need so much in terms of resources. Should be interesting to see as we go into 2024 how all this will play out. Raul, you talked about leadership. There was new leadership here. And then we have Speaker John Burns. We have Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones. And I know Speaker Burns spoke after the voucher vote. I want to take a listen to that.
That was a tough vote. A tough vote for many of my members. Balancing the needs in our educational system. I'm sure you'll see that issue come before us again next year in some form as we continue to work to provide parents and children with greater choice.
And Sam, I'm curious, first of all, do you think this will come up again? And also, what did Burns say about his first session as Speaker?
You know, I think in a lot of ways you hear him trying to carry on the legacy of Speaker David Ralston, especially in relation to mental health, which we haven't talked about yet, but that didn't make it this year, got caught up in the negotiations between the House and Senate. But you also saw him, you know, willing to take on some of these issues like vouchers. He said it was good that there was a vote and we got to see where members land on it. He said he couldn't vote on it, but he would have had he had the chance. So I think it'll be interesting to see what crops up again next year. Vouchers was pushed by the governor at the end. Mm-hmm. And that's enough. You talk about leadership. It's been interesting, too, to see the role that Governor Kemp has played in this session, fresh off a reelection where he's not currently running for something.
Interesting. And also with Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones, his first session in that position, he's a leader. He spoke in a presser about one of the bills that didn't make it this year as well.
You know, it had a price tag of $72 million on it when it came over to the Senate. It was just like any other bill. It was being vetted through the committee process and things of that nature. It was a gap that was too far to close for this year. But like I said, that bill's still alive and it'll be available for next year. And we'll work with the House on getting language that our side can agree to, and hopefully it won't be such a big price tag attached to it.
Raul, he's talking about mental health here.
He's talking about the mental health legislation. And you know, when you're talking about those dynamics, I am, you know, we already mentioned the House-Senate dynamics. Another thing I took away from my conversations last night is also, what is the dynamic between the Senate and the governor? And then maybe even what's the dynamic between the House and the governor? You know, there were some things said by the governor that perked my ears.
Two different messages to the House and
exactly.
Senate in some moments.
By the way, that was one of the interesting. So Governor Kemp addressed both bodies last mm-hmm. night. And the speeches were slightly different, but it jumped out at me about, you know, he didn't talk about mental health over in the Senate where I was sitting, but he talked about
it. In the House, he came in and said, we're going to keep working on this, whether it's this session or next session, acknowledging that this didn't.
And then the governor also brought up a specific tax break bill and said, y'all need to get this passed or I'm going to call a special session. He said that in the Senate. So, and then he also
mentioned there were some budget holes.
Exactly.
To the Senate.
That was the other thing I was going to mention. He mentioned budget holes. And so, you know, those things made my ears perk up. And then when I combine it with some of the other conversations with Senate leaders, makes me wonder, what are the dynamics, maybe not on the level of, you know, between, you know, Burt Jones and the governor, but maybe the people below. Mm-hmm. There are some questions about dynamics and power and all of that, because, you know, these guys have still got to work together at least for one more year.
Absolutely. And before we let you go, real quickly, are folks going to be still getting boots on their vehicles?
That bill was never, ever called up.
Sorry, Georgia.
And you know, that was...
We tried, Georgia.
I do have one little gem for you, though.
What you got?
You know I always bring you one little gem. There was a little line added to a Senate bill to end pre-filing of legislation.
Really?
Yeah. You know how... And think about it. Last year, half of my stories in December were like pre-filed bills, yeah. You know, things that were, or else we didn't talk about many pre-files, but.
Yeah, we had runoffs to cover Rowell.
Oh, that's right. Oh my God.
It's endless.
But, you know, ending pre-filing of bills, which, you know, people do that up. But I do want to mention one other thing. I'd love for you all to check out our work at wabe.org/underthegolddome. Mm-hmm. You know, Sam puts out some amazing, amazing pieces, and we've got bill trackers and all sorts of things for people to read.
So the bottom line is, folks can still get a boot on their vehicle. Yes. What you're saying?
Yep.
But are we going to have heavier trucks on the roadways?
Yes, but it's very, very narrow. It's not going to be a ton of roads. This is a conversation that's going to be revisited within the next 1 to 2 years.
Raw milk.
No.
All right, just checking, because, you know, we got to check with that.
You know, I didn't check whether they put the... No, remember, raw milk is done. I don't remember if the funding is in there. Now I'm going to go back and check the funding. There was originally $177,000 for that in the budget.
Where is that going to go toward?
For the Department of Agriculture to implement it.
With raw milk, don't you just put it in a bottle?
Yeah, but you got to have inspectors and stuff.
Well, if it's raw, then what are you expecting?
I don't know.
I just want to note one more thing before we get out of here. And that's that sessions are technically 2 years.
Yes.
Unlike last year, which was the end of a 2-year session and stuff that didn't make it, it dies. We have another year.
Yes,
so bills that didn't end, didn't get a final vote, those can get picked back up where they were without having to start from scratch. So this continues. And it's an election year next year. So that'll be interesting.
Keep hope alive for no more booting. WAB politics reporters Raul Bali and Sam Greenglass. You can find a roundup of what bills cleared this session at wab.org/2023. And Sam and Raul, thank you so much for your work this session. And listen, on behalf of the entire Closer Look team, all five of us, and the entire Atlanta region, we say thank you, thank you, thank you. And we're going to play some Isaac Hayes to say thank you as well. Hit it, Sawyer.
Thanks, Rose.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As you just heard, another legislative session under the Gold Dome has come and gone. And we'll continue our wrap-up coverage with a focus on mental health. Now, House Bill 520 was expected to pass with bipartisan support, but it did not make it. And Democratic Representative Mary Margaret Oliver said House Bill 520 got stalled in the Senate. But to give us some more insight into how this was handled, this mental health bill, I'm joined now by State Senator Sheikh Roman. He represents the 5th District in Gwinnett County. Welcome. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Glad to be here. You know, this is my first time at WAB, and I was excited when I got invited. I said, wait a minute, why are you inviting me, you know?
Well, we would like to talk to all of y'all, but you know what? That's a whole lot of talking.
Then I realized it's okay. It's better be me than anybody else. So I was glad to be here, you know?
Well, we appreciate it. Listen, what happened with House Bill 520 through your lens? What was needed that obviously didn't happen to get this passed?
You know what? To me, is a casualty of it's becoming like a larger issue. Become a pawn issue in struggle between the House and Senate, new leaderships. You know, and also you tied in with some of the legislation. I'm sure you have heard them talk about the Cohen and the Wellstar and the potentially sports betting. You never know because we have a new leadership in both House and the Senate. And even for us, it took us a little bit of time to get used to what's going on. So that was part of it. I'm not going to say all of them. That definitely, you know, affected.
For you, was there language or some mandates or provisions in this bill that you felt needed to be in there that you wouldn't budge on, or some that was that the other side wanted that you were like, no, we can't have that?
No, you know, as a matter of fact, this was a bipartisan bill, and this was a companion bill that, you know, the second portion of the last year, you know, it was mandated, you know, to take care of this, you know, to cover that medically necessary, you know, the systems that we have, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the second part of the bill from last year. So all the provisions we have, and I think that's excellent. I wouldn't personally say that, you know, that wasn't the main issue.
It really was just money.
It's the money.
So everyone agreed about the measures, the mandate, the languages, whatever. That wasn't the issue. It was about money.
After all, you know, that's to me personally.
Was it a situation of we think $72 million is too much or $72 million is not enough? You heard?
Well, to me, you know, I would say the money part probably kind of right, you know, because we have to, you know, we spend, I think, you know, last year, you know, we put $50 some million in it. Because sometimes this kind of measure takes time. Mm-hmm. To really see what's going on. If you ask me now what happened, the money we looked at the last time, I wouldn't personally answer you exactly because we really don't know exactly what happened. It takes time. So I think the money part wasn't the big issues. The political part, the willingness to work together in terms of House and Senate together, that was the problem, I think.
Okay, but you said, and everyone has said this is, you had bipartisan support, and then you're saying, but there was a breakdown in the willingness to work together.
Willingness because of the other issues took prevalent over the hospital issue, the con issues, you know, CON, you know, some of the other stuff, I think. Because I'm not in the part of the leadership team, and of course we're in a part of minority, so we really don't dictate exactly what's good on the floor and how to decide.
So this comes back around again next session, how you're all going to approach this in a different manner.
Well, we just as we say, we have to work together, and we have to be vocal that we want to get it done. This is for the people of Georgia. This bill doesn't belong to a Republican or Democrat. This is the well-being for the people of Georgia, and we have to take priority, and everybody got to be part of it.
You serve on the Senate Appropriations Committee, correct?
That's correct. This is my first time on the Appropriations.
And so we've been talking about five respite centers here in Georgia, which it clearly provide a service for folks. According to the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network, which operates these, they needed at least $2.7 million to run these programs. Y'all zeroed out these funds that the House had provided. You know?
Again, as I said, this bill became a kind of pawn to me. On the larger issue.
You weren't in favor of something like
that. Definitely. Yeah. I was in favor. I do not want to cut any public service, anything. Somehow, I'm always for to provide anything, everything that we can for the people of Georgia. And somehow, you know.
I have a segment coming up after this where I'm going to talk to an organization that primarily focuses on mental health needs for Latino kids and youth. And when you think about mental health resources that are needed for that population, and then you throw in the rest of the population, you know, can you understand constituents listening, maybe not blaming you, but saying, you know, you all have recognized that this is a serious, critical issue here in Georgia, much like maternal mortality or you know, lung cancer or whatever issue. And we're coming out of, we're still dealing with COVID, although we believe we've gotten past the really, really bad part of this pandemic. So how can you all cannot come together and figure something out to for funding for mental health in this state?
It's unfortunate. Again, I have to say it's unfortunate, but I think will happen. It's a matter of time, you know, a matter of my concern that I have. Everybody has to speak up. And I, you know, I'm aware of it, and I know the legislature is aware of it, and I'm not sure how much public outcry was out there. We probably need to have more people out, you know, out, public outcry, and just coming to this program than you raising this concern. And as a citizen, concerned citizen of the state of Georgia, everybody has to be vocal. And I think that we're going to come back. We're not going back. Mm-hmm. I think the first time, the last year, we took the first step. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to continue. We just can't give up.
You are also part of Georgia's first legislative Asian American Pacific Islander Caucus. This was needed. Obviously, there was Hispanic Caucus as well. This was historic for Georgia. When you think about the importance of AAPI representation in the legislature and the needs of the population that you represent, how would you assess this first year for you all as a caucus?
I think this is the first step for us because we have a voice. We are one of the largest AAPI caucuses. For whatever reason, we are there. So we're speaking out for not only our folks, not only Asian American. We want a coalition with Hispanic caucuses, African American caucuses, every minority group. Not, you know, what we do, how we approach things, I think this would be better for minority mm-hmm. as a whole, as a group. And we have a bigger power, I think, you know. If we can work together, we can make it, you know, things happen better for all of us.
What is your process when the session is over and you go back to your district? Do you have town halls with them? Do you meet with constituents? You talk to them and then do you present what you want to maybe get done the next session?
Definitely. You know, we'll be continuing. We'll be looking and talking to folks in my districts and around the Georgia, in fact, because we have to absorb what people, you know, say to us mm-hmm. and we have to take back their concern because you know, we represent them. I wouldn't be at the Capitol if people didn't vote for me, so definitely, you know, we have to listen to them.
How do you sum up this legislative session? You all couldn't get the mental health funding bill in order, but overall, how do you, for you personally?
For personally, I think it took us a little bit time to get off the ground because of the new leadership. Mm-hmm. It's everybody has a different styles. We have, from both houses. So I think the folks from the cross from aisles, they had to get used to it. And I don't think we work really as a group. Uh-huh. So I think next year we're going to do better. The reason I think we're going to do better because we understand now what they're coming from, what their priorities. And they probably know what's our priority. So I think we can work better next session.
What's a priority for you?
My priority, as I said, anything that helps people of Georgia, average folks, that's my priority. Mental health is my priority. Education is my priority. You know, healthcare is my priority. Mm-hmm. Not only my priority, I think it's most of the Georgia's priority.
Sure.
So we have to look at every single Georgia. It's not that I may be from metro area, mm-hmm. but the mental health issues, education issue, this is an issue for the state of Georgia. We are facing same problem the rural Georgia is facing. Their problem may be a little different than ours, mm-hmm. the geographically may be a little different, but we all facing mm-hmm. somewhere in Georgia that we have to look out for. You know, this is for every single Georgian, for 11 million. It's not from the 200 folks that voted for me in Gwinnett County.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Access to mental health resources is something that everyone wants in this state.
Not only one, need it too.
Yeah.
Everybody has a problem. We may have some problem metro area a little bit more because of the population, but mental health, it's a national problem. It's not necessarily on Georgia mm-hmm. or in my district. So we have to do a better job in terms of not only Georgia as a country, as a citizen, we are number one state in the country to do a business.
Well, that's what they keep saying,
they're
Senator.
Saying. But the thing is, we are not number one state for mental health and, you know, childhood mortality and all other, you know, education and health. And those are our priority. Those should be our priority. And I won't be proud of say, you know, Georgia is a place that we care for people.
Mm-hmm. So that we can all do business.
We can all do business. You know, if we are not healthy and we are not well educated.
Can't do anything.
We can't do anything.
Yeah. State Senator Sheikh Rahman, it was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for coming and taking the time. Your first visit to Closer Look. How do you feel?
I feel great. You know, I was honored to be here. I you know, I'm not a junkie that you listen to radio all the time, but whenever I get a time, I listen to Closer Look, and I'm a fan of yours. When I get invitation, I say, well, I get to meet her, and I'm going to be there. I might mess it up, but that's okay. But I'll be there.
Well, you wouldn't be the first. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be here and looking forward to coming to your program in the future.
You will. Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott, and actually we're going to continue with this conversation about mental health because the reports are plenty, and there's data to reveal a surge in mental health crises among young adults and youth. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 34 in this nation. In case you're wondering, gun violence is the leading cause. And we know that suicide impacts all races, ethnicities, and gender. But recently, there has been an uptick in suicides in vulnerable populations. Now, to break this down, understand this. On today's show, we want to focus on the mental health of Latino and Hispanic youth and what's being done locally to support them. My next guest is Belisa Urbina, who's the CEO of Sir Familia. And if you're not familiar, it's a local nonprofit that focuses on behavior and mental health among Latinos. Belisa, welcome to the program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You know, you might have heard some of that conversation I just had with the state senator there. When you think about the mental health resources that are needed in this state, and I'm not asking you to get political, but that lawmakers couldn't work it out because of funding. You know, what kind of message does that send to someone like you who needs resources, if possible, that you could get from the state? Because you're working with a population here.
Certainly, yes. And I was listening to the conversation with a lot of interest, and something that he said resonated with me is that if we are not healthy, we can do anything. And that's true. You know, we have a lot of dreams for our Latino youth, but we are facing a crisis when it comes to mental health on all kids, but in Latino kids in particular. And not having the funding that is needed to help in that is important.
You know, there was a report that came out, according to the American Psychiatric Association, Hispanic, and I know you know this, Hispanic and Latino youth report disproportionate rates of what they call suicidal ideation and suicide attempts in 2019. 1 in 6 of Hispanic and Latino high school students had serious thoughts of suicide. 1 in 6.
Yes. And if you look at the CDC statistics before the pandemic, and certainly when we see the ones after these 3 years of the pandemic, they're going to be certainly much worse. Latino kids in Georgia, their outcomes are worse than Latino kids almost anywhere else in the nation. So we had a crisis way before the pandemic started that we have been talking about and sounding the alarm bells on. because we have more instances, Latino kids in Georgia have more instances of severe depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation than almost any other child in the U.S.
And so now we are talking about this problem, and then here comes the other part of a process and something like this, and that's barriers or systemic challenges that prevent or are preventing this population, our Hispanic and Latino youth, from receiving mental health care. Is it strictly about resources that are out there? Is that the issue? There's not enough.
There's not enough. There's other issues for sure that complicate, you know, the landscape. But lack of resources is at the top of the list because we don't have enough clinicians as it is. To give you a perspective, we have more than 700,000 Latinos in Metro Atlanta. But we have all in all between social workers, counselors, psychiatrists and psychologists, we have less than 100 that are fully licensed who can speak Spanish. And always the question is why in Spanish? Because even if the kids can speak English, your feelings are in your native language. And in a moment of crisis, they're going to revert most times to their native language to express those feelings.
How do you all try to fill in the gap there?
We have been doing a lot of internal movements as an agency because certainly we are seeing three times the number of kids with suicidal ideation. As a matter of fact, we have a survivor who is 8 years old. That's a baby. Can you imagine an eight-year-old that has already attempted suicide? So yes, the situation has become complicated. What we have done? Identify resources so we can increase the number of case managers. In our case, case managers are not licensed clinicians. They are people with the right education and training who can serve as family advocates, who can guide families, do assessments on the kids and the adults. We have also contracted, you know, even out of state, some people that can help us out. And another thing is that we have started to do group therapy when it comes to teens, which we didn't do before the pandemic. In a partnership with Emory University, now we're doing something called Sparks, which is group therapy for teenagers, trying to make sure that we can serve more of those kids.
But Lisa, you said an eight-year-old attempted to die by suicide.
Yes, we have a client who is 8 years old, who is a survivor of suicide. And sadly, we are not the only ones with cases like that. So it's very worrisome, and certainly we need to devote more resources. We need to do more. Ser Familia has been working in conjunction with other agencies so that we can identify making Georgia more attractive for clinicians to come. We also have to make changes in, you know, what are the parameters for people to get licensed as a mental health clinician in Georgia, because we ask for those people that have already, you know, the right training, their master's degree. We require more hours than almost any other states. And there are some hurdles, especially for minority communities, Latinos, Blacks. You know, we're going to find more hurdles to get licensed, you know, after ending up with a master's degree and a massive student debt. If we need to supervise an inordinate amount of hours, which are so expensive, you know, it becomes a hurdle. People, you know, complete their master's, but they are not able to get licensed.
I spoke to someone with DeKalb County Schools not too long ago who talked about for every 2,100 students in the district, there was maybe one licensed school psychologist. And when I'm thinking about, you said in Metro, 700,000 Latinos in Georgia, and then you break that down to youth, and you need bilingual youth counselors in the area. That number just dwindles in terms of who's available.
Correct. You are absolutely right. As far as we know, there are just a handful of psychiatrists that can speak Spanish that are able to treat children and adolescents in our state. We are lucky to have a contract with one of them. But nonetheless, the numbers are so high that you're constantly triaging. And how can you decide who has the biggest trauma? Who has the biggest need? Mm-hmm. Who do I need to take care of first? Who do I need to refer? So those are decisions that you do every day that are gut-wrenching.
Are there times when you all are you have to reach out to another organization or have to seek another entity to help someone? Because perhaps you all can't provide a service, an immediate service right then and there. Do you come across that sometimes?
That's constant, Rose, because honestly, you know, and the thing is, what it makes it very sad is that many times when we have to refer, there's nowhere to refer. Because if you are, you need mental health in Spanish, you are uninsured, you don't have a way of paying for it. And even more, you might be undocumented or in a mixed status families. There's no, most of the times, there's nowhere else to send, you know, these clients. So we are on a dead end street. So that's why we have increased. Ser Familia provides a lot of programming that is evidence-based programming through family classes like Triple P parenting, mm-hmm. strengthening families. These are effective interventions that have been proven to work, and you don't need a clinician to do that. So that's an area that we have increased quite a bit our output because it's a way of bringing the family. Also, you cannot serve the children in isolation, the teens in isolation. Mm-hmm. You need to provide services from the optic of a family in which you involve, however you define the family, you involve all of the people mm-hmm. that are in direct contact with that child on an everyday basis.
And then there's another population within the population, and that is your LGBTQI Latino teens and youth. There's a whole nother set of resources that they need as well.
Correct, 100%. And, you know, we luckily, we understand that we are perceived as, you know, open and friendly to the LGBTQ community. And we have several clients who are members of the trans community that come to our domestic violence programs. And you know, from what we gather, they get a lot of help and they feel very supported. But once again, we need more of that. Something Ser Familia is intent is in helping other smaller nonprofits gain capacity and sustainability. To give you an idea, Rose, in Cobb County, we have been the only Latino specific for 23 years. And Cobb County has gone from 4% Latino when Ser Familia started 22 years ago to about 14% Latino now. But one in three children in Cobb schools is a Latino child.
Yeah.
So is this unsustainable?
You know, I was participating in a forum earlier today, and it dealt with workforce development. And I feel like when these forums are great, and it's always we end with the same sort of, I guess, marching orders, which it takes a collective, it takes willpower, it takes partnerships across for-profit, non-profit, it takes policy, it takes all of this. In other words, it takes a holistic approach to get through this. But with the work that you all have been doing, the holistic approach is missing. It's got some holes in it, right? Who do you need help from? What sector?
I think that we need, you know, help from many sectors, not only the government sector in terms of funding and, you know, working on making sure that we can license clinicians or we take a whole new approach. We have been doing work to bring clinicians from Puerto Rico, as an example, and make Georgia attractive to do that. Certainly, we need help from partners and we need help from the private, you know, private organizations, you know, corporations, businesses that can help us also in our quest of being able to serve every child. Many times we have kids from the trans community that don't have an ID, mm-hmm. and then we need private funds to serve them.
And speaking of that, I have a message from a listener who says, Rose, I am Latino, and I have a big trust in some of these organizations because some people in my family are undocumented. And you spoke to that.
Yes.
I just got that from someone.
Thank you. And obviously, you know, I never, you know, hide who do we serve and who do we love, because I think that to serve, you have to love. And, you know, that you mentioned holistic approach, and that has been the Ser Familia model from the beginning. We assess a whole family, we create a plan that is specific to that family, and then we stay with them for whatever time it takes. It might be 2 weeks, it might be 2 years. We want them to be thriving, and that requires funding and time. And that is what makes it difficult, because now it requires more funding and more time because problems are more complicated.
As we wrap up, Elisa, what message do you want to give to leave with families and youth and a population that you are serving who may be struggling with mental health or need some resources? What do you want them to know?
Do not despair. There is help. Not only us, there are organizations out there that are there to help you. If we cannot help you, we're going to connect you to help. But many times that lack of hope is what is, you know, the worst of all of this. Do not despair. There is hope and people get better. People go through very difficult times, but people recover and get better.
Mm-hmm. Belisa Urbina, the CEO of Ser Familia, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for the work that you all do helping so many people. And by the way, if you or someone you know are in crisis, please call or text 988. And again, you can reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Belisa, thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that is it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are Daniel Rizal and LaShawn Hudson. Tiffany Griffin is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. And a reminder, let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it is online, wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m., as well as in our podcasts. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like and check out our other podcasts as well. Stay tuned to WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.